You are listening to a free version of the Majority Report with Sam Steeder. To support this show and get another 15 minutes of daily program, go to majority.fm, please.
The Majority Report with Sam Steeder.
It is Wednesday, August 17th, 2022. My name is Sam Steeder. This is the five-time award-winning Majority Report. We are broadcasting live steps from the industrially ravaged Gowanus Canal in the heartland of America, downtown Brooklyn, USA. On the program today, Brian Colicci, chief economist at the Open Markets Institute, on inflation as an excuse for squeezing workers. Then we'll be talking to Alana Marchucci Morris, a Kaiser Permanente mental health therapist who is on strike with 1,999 other mental health therapists out in California. Meanwhile, Joe Biden signs the Build Back a Bit bill as Manchin's side deal already in peril. And Liz Cheney loses her primary. Apparently, Lynn also did not win her primary. I am unclear on which one of those two ran, but neither won.
And good riddance to both.
Indeed. In Alaska, Murkowski and Palin advance in their primaries, but the door is open for a Democrat to win the special election. Unlikely, but Giuliani testifies in Atlanta under a judge's order. Florida court bars a 16-year-old from getting an abortion because she lacks the maturity to make that decision. Meanwhile, in Louisiana, a woman was forced to carry a headless fetus to term or travel to Florida for abortion care. Biden cancels $3.9 billion of student debt owed to the now defunct ITT. FDA clears hearing aids to be sold over the counter. This is a big deal, actually. Long time coming. Meanwhile, an entire Texas County election staff resigns because of death threats they're getting from Republicans. All this and more on today's Majority Report. Welcome, ladies and gentlemen. It is Wednesday. Emma Vigeland is out at the moment for on a COVID retreat that we allowed her to go to. It's sort of like a trust camp, but you get COVID there, and you go, and she's hanging in there. She's been ill, not deathly ill, but ill. And hopefully she'll make an appearance over the next couple of days and hopefully next week. Or Matt better be...
Or it's going to be American Truck Simulator. We're going to be driving from Wyoming to Arizona and back again.
I'd watch that.
Matt's bringing the PC in.
We may have a very different week of Majority Reports. Well, they used to be like on a very different episode of the Majority Report. Matt just lets his game freak fly. Meanwhile, socialist bear in Chicago on the IM on today's episode of the Majority Report. Will this IM be read out on air? Tune in and find out. Well, there you go. You just found out. All right, let's get into this. Joe Biden, and this is interesting insofar as... There is no, and I have spared no critique of Joe Biden and his administration for dropping the ball the moment after the COVID relief bill was signed in February or March, I think it was, of 2021. That was the moment to strike. Not invite Republicans in and have a conversation with them and dilly-dally and show the country that you're being bipartisan. And then just to show how bipartisan you're being, you allow Sinema and Portman to come in. And this was the beginning of the end for the Build Back Better bill that he had been promoting. It ultimately got split up into two bills. One was an infrastructure bill, and then the Build Back Better got destroyed by Manchin. The rest is history. And we could see, we saw reporting over the course of that summer. Manchin meeting with no labels. Manchin calling this person like, hey, my buddies need a job after they get out of the Senate. And you cannot let the opposition. We saw it in the context, actually, of that of the tax that Manchin wanted to impose on corporations in this bill that was signed here. And with a little bit of time and delay, then all of a sudden the people who opposed it were able to rally. This is, you know, this is the thing. There is like these are all human beings. And in the same way, like around here, I say we're going to begin to monetize the AM Quickie. And then 4 months later, we still haven't done it because I got busy with other things. It wasn't my primary agenda. But even if it was the primary agenda, it still takes time to marshal these forces. They're not sitting just waiting to pounce. It may take months, may take weeks. So he needed to move quickly. At the very least, there seems to be, and it took the Obama administration, I think, a term and a half to understand this. There seems to be an awareness, at least by Joe Biden, that that game is over. Not that any more legislation is going to pass anyways, at least, contingent upon what happens in 2022 in November. But at the very least, if the Democrats are lucky enough to retain the Senate and somehow retain the House, you may see a different strategy if they go forward with anything. I don't know that they will, but it's just talk. But with Joe Biden, you're not hearing that same, like, the Republicans are going to come around after 2022 when they take control of the Senate or something. Here he is signing that bill.
The Inflation Reduction Act does so many things that for so many years, so many of us have fought to make happen. And let's be clear. In this historic moment, Democrats sided with the American people, and every single Republican in the Congress sided with the special interest in this vote. Every single one. In fact, the big drug companies spent nearly $100 million to defeat this bill. $100 million. And remember, every single Republican in Congress voted against this bill. Every single Republican in Congress voted against lowering prescription drug prices, against lowering health care costs, against the fair tax system. Every single Republican, every single one, voted against tackling the climate crisis, against lowering our energy costs, against creating good-paying jobs. My fellow Americans, that's the choice we face. We can protect the already powerful or show the courage to build a future where everybody has an even shot. That's the America I believe in. That's what I believe in. And today, we've come a step closer to making that America real. Today, too often, we confuse noise with substance. Too often, We confuse setbacks with defeat. Too often, we hand the biggest microphones to the critics and the cynics who delight in declaring failure, while those committed to making real progress do the hard work of governing. Making progress in this country is as big and complicated as ours clearly is not easy. It's never been easy. But with unwavering conviction, commitment, and patience, progress does come. Your dad was right. And when it does, like today, people's lives are made better, and the future becomes brighter, and a nation can be transformed. That's what's happening now.
I mean, I'm a little bit more, I retain some of my cynicism in terms of the transformation part. That's all well and good. Glad he could make it through that part of the speech. But the bottom line is that, at the very least, using this opportunity to make it clear that Republicans were against every part of it is important and helpful. Also, we should say that yesterday, Shida Tlaib, in a statement to the American Prospect, says handshake deals made by others in closed rooms do not dictate how I vote, and we sure as hell don't owe Joe Manchin anything now. He and his fossil fuel donors already got far too much in the IRA. My yes vote today is not quiet acceptance of the Manchin poison pill. She was talking about her vote for the passage of the IRA in the House. This was on Friday. We will be united in defeating the separate Manchin permitting reforms, that will accelerate climate change and pollute black, brown, and indigenous and low-income communities. And she writes, now that the IRA has passed, she continued, there's absolutely zero reason that Congress should follow through in a backdoor handshake deal that directly undermines the purpose of the IRA. Manchin went back on his word to get Build Back Better done, and we owe him nothing now. I like it. It's the way you do that.
That's great, yeah.
So we shall see. Maybe they'll pass it with Republican votes, but that would be pretty hilarious. Particularly considering once we get past November, they're going to be in, you know, keep Biden a one-term president mode. Now, presumably they also would extend that to any Democrat running in 2022 or 2024, but we shall see. All right. Before we take a break and bring Brian Colicci on, word from our sponsor, Aura. It's one of our sponsors today. You've heard me talk about Aura before. It's an app I use to protect my data from hackers, scammers, and spammers. And really, the part that I like about it is that I don't really have to do, I don't do anything. I just sign up for it. Sometime last week, I got a notice. I cannot tell you how many websites I've, e-commerce sites I may have, I must have like signed up for passwords for. Like I've stopped doing that. Like I take the guest route now more often than not. But there's a lot out there. There was one I signed up. It must have been something I was fishing around for like cheaper diabetic cat food. And I had totally forgotten about it. Apparently, they had a breach. Aura let me know that my special email that I used to sign up for stuff like that got breached there. Checked the password. I went back. Made a slight change to my other passwords. I feel better about it. Real question is, what are you doing to protect yourself? If the answer is nothing, well, then I highly recommend you try Aura. Here's how it works. Aura monitors constantly, 24/7, the dark web. They're looking for your emails, passwords, social security numbers, and they will send an alert fast to your phone or email when they find anything. Aura also gives you near real-time alerts on suspicious credit inquiries. Somebody was opening a loan or a credit card in your name. They automatically send requests on your behalf to data brokers to remove your information, which help reduce the amount of spam and robocalls you receive. Their antivirus software blocks malware and viruses before they infect your devices. Look, identity theft is so common, there's a new victim every 14 seconds. That's nuts. And it costs the average victim over $1,000. You can protect your family and yourself from identity theft at aura.com/majority. When you head there and you put in your email address, they'll check it to you and give you feedback right then. When you sign up right now, Aura will give you 2-week free trial with my link so you can see for yourself how many times Aura finds you or your family members' personal info on the dark web. If you sign up, let me know in the comments below if your personal information has been compromised. You will not regret checking it. Again, that's Aura, aura.com/majority. Try Aura for free for 14 days at aura.com/majority. All right, going to take a quick break. And when we come back, we'll be talking to Brian Colicci, chief economist at the Open Markets Institute, on his essay, In Dissent, Inflation is No Excuse for Squeezing Workers. We'll be right back after this. We are back. Sam Seder on the Majority Report. Joining me, Brian Colicci. He is the chief economist at the Open Markets Institute. He has co-written a piece in Dissent magazine with Sandeep Vahisan. Inflation is no excuse for squeezing workers. Welcome to the program, Brian.
Thanks for having me.
All right. Let's just start with where we are in terms of inflation at this point. I just saw a report today that UK inflation is top 10%, which I think basically shows that their inflation is a little bit more than ours. But explain at least the overall sort of, I guess, the conventional wisdom as to where we are in terms of inflation, and maybe the conventional wisdom as to what is causing it.
Sure. So, first of all, you mentioned the UK. So, because inflation appears to be an international phenomenon, it seems unlikely it's being caused by things like, the American Rescue Plan stimulus, people getting $1,400 checks, even the low unemployment rate, things like that. So with that, I think there is a misdiagnosis out there of inflation as being caused by, workers getting too much bargaining power, workers' wages rising too quickly. And that is causing some policymakers, I think, to unfortunately lose their nerve about this sort of policy environment we've had, particularly with low unemployment, that's allowed workers to get some bargaining power and increase their wages. So they're calling for the Federal Reserve to engineer a recession, which would raise the unemployment rate. What the Federal Reserve can do is it can raise interest rates, that slows down investment, that'll raise the unemployment rate, which will lower wages, and then we'll all get lower inflation, but we also have lower wages.
I just want to put a pin in this for a minute, but I increasingly am becoming skeptical of the assessment that it's a misdiagnosis as opposed to a purposeful, I don't know what the word is, for a purposeful misdiagnosis in this instance, or a pretend misdiagnosis. But I want to put a pin in that so that we can talk about go through a couple of the things that you've mentioned in the context of your piece. Add one more element to what you talked about. You said it's pretty clear that it can't be a function of CARES or the American Rescue Plan, and the checks that Americans were getting, et cetera, because we're seeing similar inflation across the world. And not only did they not have those bills, but there's no evidence that they necessarily put more money into the hands of consumers, let's say, or their economy, because they already have these economic stabilizers in place. This was more or less, they were going ahead with, you know, there was some crisis, but it wasn't extraordinary, the actions that they took relative to the way that their economies generally function. So is it also the case that the classic idea of demand outstripping supply has to be it's a more nuanced situation, because this is not about the economy overheating as much as there are certain sectors where the economy is misaligned because we had this sort of extraordinary crisis that hit?
I think that's exactly right. Wage growth is lagging inflation. So it just on the face of it, it's difficult to explain that with wages actually driving the inflation, right? I think it's exactly right. And I think, some of the more important causes are things like supply chain bottlenecks. And that's in turn caused by decades of underinvestment, not overheating or overinvestment. And then, of course, we have, it's also hard to explain some of these price behavior, particularly in the oil and gas industry, without those companies having some pricing power, some monopoly power, which allows them to sort of sustain a price increase above what the increase in costs would otherwise predict.
You also write about the sort of natural experiment that we had on so-called artificially raising wages when over the past really 10 years of the Fight for 15 movement. Will you talk about that and explain what that natural experiment showed?
Sure. So I think, I'm an economist, but I think that many times, economists play a sort of unhelpful role in policy debates as being sort of the veto point. You can't do this. This will have unintended consequences, which if you push that pretty far, every policy has some kind of unintended consequence. It's an argument not to do anything. But up until you really have to give the Fight for 15 credit for putting this on the agenda, up until then, most economists, thought that wages are sort of set by impersonal, forces of supply and demand. So, you have a lot of employers bidding up wages and, if a worker isn't getting, workers getting paid pretty much what they contribute to the company. So, if you put an artificial ceiling, let's say artificial floor, like a union contract or a minimum wage, what would an employer do? Of course, they'll just cut back on employment. And so it's actually self-defeating, for workers to demand these kinds of raises. And what we saw with the Fight for 15, where a number of municipalities raised their minimum wages by substantial amounts in a very short time period, is that we didn't see those unemployment effects. So I think, a lot of times we really don't know what the effect of a policy is going to be. So rather than, giving the economics profession a veto where we can sort of say, oh, you can't do that, it might cause this problem, let's just do the policy and then we'll get the evidence. Because the theory has been so lacking, the only way we can know what policies we should be doing is to try, just like they did in the New Deal, try them out, let's see what happens. If it doesn't work, try something else.
I can't tell you how many debates I had generally with libertarians, but others on this program over the course of the 10 years since that movement started in 2011, what raising the minimum wage would do. And it feels like the results of that have not had as much of an impact in our conventional wisdom as the sort of anticipatory doomsayers, the attention they got. I am of the mind that really, like, economists have no business in projections as much as they do, or I should say far less business in projections as much as they do in analysis as to what happens.
Yeah, I think that's a totally correct point. I would agree with that. It's just, it's not helpful to have, to give, let, you, let yet more veto points. Elizabeth Pop Berman has a good book just came out called The Economic Style in Policymaking or something like that. And it goes into how economists sort of found this role in policy debates. And it's mostly, a sort of a way to contravene what Democratic publics would want. And you can sort of say, we would like to raise the minimum wage, but the economists say we can't do it. Or we would like to have OSHA safety rule for repetitive stress industries, but, the economists say that that's not necessary.
Okay, so let's get back to this question of the way that we're responding to the inflation, because the inflation is real. It's just that it is when the term inflation has been used in the past, it seems to me that it has been meant one thing specifically, and that this is a different thing. I mean, the impact on consumers may be similar, but the things that are driving it are different than what we traditionally think of, right? I mean, like if a hurricane hits New Orleans, we don't talk about inflation has hit New Orleans because wood costs more money or because, it costs more to, take an Uber or a cab or something. It's because there's been this extraordinary event that has messed everything up. We don't have a word for that, it feels like. And you cite a couple of different writers who have pointed out, the different causes that we're getting for inflation. So will you just outline those again? I mean, it's clearly not wages because wages are lagging from inflation. What are the other things that are suspected or, clearly causing the increase in prices in specific sectors?
Yeah, so that's the basic point, is that inflation, that term, as you mentioned, refers to sort of a general rise in prices, which, you could say in past periods, maybe, the 1960s was caused by sort of a economy that was reaching its sort of limits. But this current one is more of a change in sort of relative prices, it's sector specific. And that's a very big, difference. The pandemic caused people, but not only disrupted supply chains, it caused people to shift their consumption from services to goods, which caused backups at the ports. And the big, current issue right now is the war in Ukraine. And that's not something that American unemployment rates, Federal Reserve policy is going to affect. The course of that, and the course of, some more longer term things that we could do to fight inflation would be, boost investment, rebuild those supply chains, and transition to greener energies that aren't subject to these sort of, price shocks.
You also cite Mike Konzel and Nico Luzzini of the Roosevelt Institute. I think we had Mike on to talk about this very dynamic, but that monopoly power in certain sectors also is driving inflation.
Yeah, and I wouldn't say it didn't start the fire, but it's accelerating it. And so how that works is, you have these companies in concentrated industries. And there's been some great work coming out of the Groundwork Collaborative, just documenting the earnings calls. This is somewhere where there's no secret. They tell you that they're doing it. Pepsi said, "Oh, we've realized we can raise the price of Coca-Cola more than we thought we could. Even after the costs come down, we're going to keep that high price point." And that's also a signal to Pepsi to do the same thing. So when you have these concentrated industries, that dynamic of Paul Krugman also recently brought attention to it, called rockets and feathers, where when costs go up, companies in concentrated industries are able to sort of raise those prices very quickly. And then they kind of stay there. And then when the costs start falling again, the prices don't come down nearly as fast. So yeah, it's hard to get that kind of dynamic without some kind of corporations having monopoly pricing power in their product markets.
Okay, so this gets to my little bailiwick here, and it's both for the description of economists, sort of saying like you can't have a rise in the minimum wage because you're going to get less employment. That's just the way that it works in these businesses. And also, we've had the Fed now four rises in the interest rate. Actually, before we get to this point, explain to us why that is done. Like, I mean, that seems to be the primary, you know, aside from Joe Manchin using it as a fig leaf, you know, and talking about the deficit, et cetera, et cetera. The Fed seems to be the only tool that we have that is deployed in terms of inflation, whereas we could also, you know, build more robust supply lines, or we could have a little bit more industrial planning. We could have more antitrust so that we don't have these disparate factors, that the timeline on that may be longer in some instances. Mm-hmm. But why does the Fed raise rates? What like, or ostensibly, why do they raise rates? To address inflation.
Yeah. So I think, you've touched on a couple of really important points here. I think that, you know, we unfortunately have given the Federal Reserve outsized, influence and power over the business cycle, over the unemployment rate and whether we're in recession. And that's mostly, I think, a lack of, political will from the elected branches that kind of, you know, sort of, you know, they don't want to handle it. So they sort of outsource it to the Federal Reserve. But I would like to see a more robust role for fiscal policy, automatic, you know, unemployment insurance payments, something like a public option for jobs, what people call a job guarantee, or all kinds of other fiscal policies. I would be very much, in addition to robust antitrust and reinvesting in those supply chains. But I would say that, you know, what I find kind of funny about the arguments, I'll just say, like, two of the most prominent economists making these, we need to raise the unemployment rate through raising interest rates to cool the economy argument, is they really sound like sort of old school Marxists who made the argument that capitalism cannot support full employment, right? It'll reduce the profit rates of businesses, and then, you know, there'll be a recession. The Keynesian view is like, no, it can. We just have to, you know, use some tools, you know, to manage the economy. And that goes beyond the Federal Reserve setting interest rates. But yeah, it's the idea is that the economy is at its potential. You know, we can't produce more stuff. Workers' wage demands will get too high. So it's kind of also a bleak view, yeah, that we're doing the best we can instead of we should try to push to do better.
I just want to explain to people, when you say fiscal, you're talking about fiscal policy as opposed to monetary policy. Fiscal, yes. Policy is what the government spends and what it does, more or less. Monetary policy is the Federal Reserve controlling how much money is literally available out there, particularly in terms of, more or less in terms of credit. But will you explain, you know, for us non-economists, what the relationship is between the interest rates going up and employment going down?
Gotcha. Yeah. So this is it's not an automatic transmission belt, and I would say that Sometimes, the Federal Reserve's control over interest rates in the broader economy is overstated. It's not like they push a button and all of the private lenders, all of the, you know, money markets just automatically readjust. But basically, they have several tools. But I would say the main tool, when we talk about the Federal Reserve at their meeting, you know, raise interest rates, the tool we're talking about is something called the federal funds rate, which is basically, with some simplification, the rate at which banks can sort of lend from each other. And that's a benchmark interest rate that you'll start to see filter into other benchmark rates, like what's called the prime rate, and other interest rates. So eventually, you know, there is, and through that, businesses, when the interest rate goes up, can't borrow as much. They'll invest less. And that causes layoffs. People become unemployed, which affects the economy through two channels. The first one is they have less money to spend. They are less optimistic about the future. That cools down demand because there's less, you know, people trying, there's less people in line with you trying to buy the new car because some of your neighbors are unemployed. That's how it works. And then the other way is that the unemployment rate will affect the economy is just directly through lower labor costs. It lowers wages. And I at least would like to, you know, thank at least Larry Summers for being pretty open about this. Sometimes they talk in sort of, you know, code or try to sugarcoat it. He said, look, the unemployment rate needs to go up. And for him, that's the only way we can handle inflation.
See, this is the part that I'm a little bit suspect of, right? Like, because we know that that many of these corporations, particularly the ones that have had the highest price increases, have their profits are extraordinary. And so there seems to me to be plenty of money available if they want to invest. And it seems to me that the first order effect of rising the interest rates is cool the housing market and and cool the car essentially car sales, right? Because these are the two ones that that consumers rely on that on the interest rates most for, it seems to me. And when you cool the housing market, you increase rents. So you're actually creating inflation as far as like the consumer feels it. You're getting rid of laborers, right? Because you're not building as much because people aren't buying existing homes as much. So people aren't going out and building more. So it's like very targeted at hitting a certain class of worker and a certain class of consumer in terms of like renters paying more, which means they have less money in their pocket. And so they're hoping to slow down consumer spending, it seems to me. And it's also the same with the vehicles, right? I mean, you have an older vehicle, you know, the people who are working in the car factories, they're not making any money. I mean, it seems to me sort of like targeted there. I'm not quite convinced that it curbs corporations from doing anything other than signaling to them that like it's inflation. We're in an inflation period. So if you can raise your prices, do it. If you can't, like, I'm not convinced that this is more of an opportunity just to stifle wages than it to do anything else in terms of the economy. And I guess that's like, you know, where I was heading towards is that, is this really a misdiagnosis or is it just seen as an opportunity where we can, for whatever reason, we had a lot of people leave the job force during COVID. We had a lot of people decide like, you know what, I'm rejiggering my priorities. I don't need to buy as many things as I, you know, or do as many things as I had been before. And I'm willing not to work as much for it, or I'm willing to raise my standards. So there's this sort of like, to the extent that there's inflation, it was there in wages first, you know, because we had months of people saying we can't find anybody to work. And this is a way exclusively of disciplining workers. And they use the excuse of inflation as a cover. Am I being too conspiratorial here? I mean, in other words, like the title of your piece for me would not be inflation is no excuse for squeezing workers. It's that inflation is an excuse for squeezing workers.
Yeah, you know, that's a good point. So I should say, yeah, the unemployment, you know, sort of workers' other options has a couple of different effects. The first one is, yeah, it forces your employers to sort of compete against each other for your wages. So it will have an effect on wages. But the other important effect of the unemployment rate is that it makes you a little less afraid of the discipline from your boss on the job. You know, an economist call that, it's not a good term, but they call it the efficiency wage effect, or better, the labor discipline effect. And that's, for example, as an economist in the 1940s named Michel Kolesky, who argued that why, you know, even though bosses or companies, you know, could make more profits if there was full employment, there was a hot economy, why do they oppose it? And one of his big examples is they would lose that threat of labor discipline. They would lose that ability. So that's why one of the policies we propose in the piece is what's called just cause protections, which is every worker, you know, you just get, your boss can't just fire you because they don't like you or because whatever. They have to give a reason, which is what one of the things that almost every union contract will already do for you. But yeah, yeah. The disciplinary effect is certainly a part of it.
And we're going to link to the piece. I think people should read those things. But I think, you know, like fundamentally, I think there needs to be an understanding that part of the reason why there would be reluctance to the policies you propose. And we've talked about these on this program quite a bit, you know, things like at will employment, things like further antitrust, things like, labor practices and strengthening unions. I'm not convinced that at least there's, you know, not that part of the reason is that we still live with this sort of like myth of this dynamic that is ostensibly, this is a misdiagnosis as opposed to like a very purposeful diagnosis. It's just that the ailment is being, you know, except for Larry Summers, is being sort of hidden from the so-called patient, I guess.
Yeah, that's an interesting perspective. I'll have to think about that one. But yeah, I think, you know, workers have been pummeled by public policy in this country for the last 40 years. So regardless of what we think is causing inflation, you know, one of the things that we try to argue in the piece is this is actually the time to try to let them lock in those gains, because this is a temporary situation. We need to get, you know, that Starbucks campaign, like Amazon campaign, needs to win. We need to lock, we need more union membership, and we need more policies that sort of, even, when a recession does come that isn't necessarily engineered by the Federal Reserve, those workers, all those gains are permanent. They don't disappear. This is new. This is only a few months, of having any kind of power.
And if these wage increases are locked in, is it conceivable that because it appears that the inflation projections and that inflation may be slowing down and may have like stopped. I mean, it's conceivable at this point. Is it possible that 6 to 8 months to 6 to 18 months out, we're going to have those wage increases are going to be still locked in, but the dynamic between prices and wages is going to shift?
Oh, yeah, I see what you're saying. So, yeah, I mean, what workers are trying to do is get their wages to keep up with inflation. So, yeah, as inflation comes down and nominal wages, right, the sort of paper, the wages on your paycheck goes up, that could start to lead to more real wage gains, as we say, inflation adjusted wage gains.
Well, we're going to put a link to your piece. It's fascinating. It has a good laundry list there of things that policymakers could do if they really wanted to lock in labor power. Brian, exactly. Kalachi, chief economist at Open Markets Institute. Thanks so much for your time today. I really appreciate it.
Thanks for having me. Anytime.
All right, folks. We're going to take a quick break. Yes. And when we come back, we're going to be talking to Alana Marchucci Morris from Kaiser Permanente. She is a mental health worker, and she is on strike with about 2,000 other workers. We'll be back in just a moment.
And Matt, my media guy, has lots of video.
All right, we're live now. We are back. Sam Seder on the Majority Report. On the phone, Alana Marcucci Morris, a Kaiser Permanente mental health therapist. Alana, thanks for joining us. Tell me exactly where you are right now. We can hear some of the background.
Hi there. I am in front of the San Leandro Medical Center of Kaiser Permanente with my colleagues from the National Union of Healthcare Workers, and we are on strike.
How many of you are?
I can give you this.
Please.
We are 2,068 mental health therapists who are overworked, and our employer has allowed our contract to expire, and we've been at the bargaining table for 13 months now, letting them know that our primary concerns are our patients. They are experiencing dangerous delays to get mental health therapy appointments. The average wait time to start with a therapist at Kaiser is about 4 to 8 weeks. And in some areas, it's as long as 3 months, like my clinic at Oakland Psychiatry. And it's simply demoralizing to tell folks struggling with their mental health, you need this medically necessary care, but I can't give it to you until 2 to 3 months from now. So that's our main issue, is the wait times for our patients, and we came up with some very creative proposals in terms of how to ensure that we can take care of the patients we have before being forced to keep a front open door and just see more and more people, therefore delaying the care to the folks we already have. Folks aren't able to get better with Kaiser's model of care, and that's why we're on the picket line.
And so is pay an issue for you guys at all, or is it exclusively just Kaiser needs to step up and basically hire more therapists to provide this care?
Listen, we live in the Bay Area too, so we want to be treated and valued just the same as any other healthcare worker. But wages are not our primary issue. We have put forth no proposals demanding higher wages. We, all of our proposals center around patient care and center around therapists having the time to do essential patient care duties. As it stands now, Kaiser just wants us to be patient-facing on a full 8 hours of the day, and for our generalists, it ends up being 1 to 2 hours more. However, the law requires that we document. We, you know, if you're a child therapist, you're going to need to talk to that patient's mother or teacher or special ed, you know, counselor. There's more to do other than the one-on-one FaceTime with the patient that is required by law, and it's also part of that patient's care. So you maybe you've seen some of the Kaiser representatives on television saying we're asking for administrative time. I don't have administrative time. Not only do I not have administrative time, that isn't what calling a parent or responding to a patient in crisis, sending me an email. That's not administrative. That is me taking care of my patient, and that is part of patient care. The difference is that Kaiser can't bill for it. So when you hear them, you know, saying that we're trying to take less time from the patients, what they're saying is less time for a billable appointment with a patient. But mental health care requires that we are available to our patients beyond their one-on-one appointments. But we're just not given the time to do that. So our patients can't get better. Therapists are drowning in burnout, and the COVID-19 pandemic has just worsened that. They have asked therapists to see more patients since the pandemic when we were already at our capacity pre-pandemic. I mean, we've been in a mental health crisis a whole lot longer than the COVID-19 crisis. So I just want to be very clear. Patient care is our primary issue. We love serving the community. Sorry, the bullhorn got cut off.
That's okay.
We love serving our patients. We love being there for them. We don't like telling them we can't see you for 2 months, even though your depression is serious. That's unethical. And now it's against the law. Ever since SB 221 passed here in California, the law says we have to see our patients every 10 days when medically necessary. So this is about following state law. This is about giving us the resources and the time we need so that our patients actually get better and get the care that they are entitled to because they pay their premium. But instead, the system is set up to send people outside to pay out of pocket for mental health care, even though they're already paying their premiums, which sets up a system for the advantage to get what they need. And for those of us that are struggling economically or facing any form of oppression, they're deteriorating. So it's set up for the advantage to get what they need, to pay out of pocket, so Kaiser doesn't have to pay for their care. And that's just unethical. It's illegal. And it's demoralizing. That's why we're here.
I was going to ask you about that question of a legal requirement to see urgent cases within 10 business days. And urgent, I guess, is, you know, a subjective term that I would trust the therapist in this this instance to assess. Is there also, right, you know, aside from the work stoppage, and I want to get back to that in a moment, but is there also any type of a legal track that's being pursued by the mental health workers? Because it seems to me Kaiser has some sort of statutory obligations to up their, you know, to up the number of staff.
Right. You know, so I'm not an attorney, so I'll try to keep within my expertise and my scope. What I can tell you is that the Department of Managed Health Care, which is the government body that oversees your health plan, is asking patients to report directly to them if they have been denied care, if their appointments have been canceled during the labor stoppage, because your health plan still has a responsibility to take care of your mental health during our labor stoppage. And, you know, we all have to be in this together. You know, we're going with them on our wages for as long as it takes so that Kaiser takes mental health care seriously. And we also need patients and members to report to the Department of Managed Health Care when they are denied care. So you can go to NUHW's website, KaiserDon'tDeny.org. I'll say it again, it's KaiserDon'tDeny, all one word, .org, and share your story and the information to report directly to the Department of Managed Health Care. You can Google them, or you can also just go to our website, and it's all there.
Okay, we will put that a link to KaiserDon'tDeny.org in both our YouTube and podcast descriptions and on the website. So give me a sense, how long do you guys, I mean, what's your sense in terms of how unified you are? Where are all the, you mentioned there's over 2,000 mental health workers who are essentially striking at this point. Where are they all located? What's your sense of how long you folks are determined to withhold your labor until Kaiser starts providing for patients?
Right. As long as it takes. We have been very busy, and our picket lines have been very full. I was in San Francisco on Monday, and we had a huge turnout. You can see some of our TikTok videos if you want to see therapists with rhythm. And then I was in Oakland yesterday, which was really big as well. Very, very inspiring to see all of our colleagues in person. It's giving me a lot of energy and fuel. So people aren't working. It's visible. It's clear. And we're going to be out as long as it takes. And I wanted to circle back to your legal question. You know, Kaiser was sued through the Department of Managed Health Care, patients who had been denied, and through the work of our union about, 6-7 years ago, because they had the same problems for that initial appointment. And since that lawsuit, Kaiser has hired a whole lot of us to do that initial appointment, because the law in the past only required that initial appointment be within 10 days. So to speak to your legal question earlier, we may have to go there again, right? Unfortunately, labor stoppages and lawsuits and hefty fines, not just the small fines, because Kaiser would rather pay a small fine than pay what it needs to do to fix the system. So if it gets to that, then, then it will get to that. So it's not something that hasn't happened before. We have organized and taken legal means as well. So, it's one step at a time.
What can folks who, aside from those patients who are not getting timely care and going to that website that we will put the link to, what can patients or what can other people do to support you folks on the line, on the picket lines, and just broadly speaking?
Sure. Thanks for asking. Well, you can always join a picket line. We're in front of nearly every Northern California Kaiser there is, Sacramento, Santa Rosa, San Rafael, San Leandro, San Jose. You name it. We're in front of every Kaiser from about 6 in the morning until 3 in the afternoon. So you can, throw a red t-shirt on and come pick up a picket sign. There are also local strike funds. I work in Oakland Psychiatry, and my colleagues have organized a strike fund. So it's a Venmo account at KP Oak Strike Fund. Oh, gosh, I hope that's right. I can text you a scanner if you want to put it to the website so folks can scan. But throwing money at us. I mean, we're not making money. We're out here for our patients and for the larger parity movement in terms of mental health, getting the same resources that the physical health care industry receives. All studies show that if your mental health is taken care of, you're going to have less heart attacks, less strokes, all of it. So this is a physical health problem too. But they can donate to any of our strike funds, and I can text those resources over so folks know how to, you know, show up financially for us, and also you know, join any of our picket lines.
Great. Great. Well, we will put all of that in the blog and in the podcast and YouTube descriptions. Is there anything else that we should know, Alana? I mean, it sounds like you guys are very determined, and hopefully, you know, this will resolve soon. But certainly, the more that people, you know, amplify this on their social media, and the more that patients know that they have an opportunity to file a complaint if they're not getting timely care at this time, the better. Is there anything else that would be helpful for us to know or that we can do for you?
Sure. I'll just close with this. A labor stoppage, a strike, is an absolute last resort. We wouldn't be here if we haven't presented the problems we're facing to our local managers, our regional directors, and the top executives of Kaiser many times before. So I have been a part of local professional practice committees. We have my colleagues formed a model of care, a model of care committee that worked collaboratively with management to correct these problems years ago, and they presented their findings last year before we even started bargaining, and Kaiser hasn't implemented any of it. And what they have implemented has been microscopic, because that plan that they put together would have really made a huge difference for our patient care and allowing our patients to actually get the care they need. So I just want to emphasize, this is not our first step. We have taken multiple avenues to work with Kaiser in a collaborative way to correct these problems, and we have consistently got the response, we are not interested in any of those proposals. So this is a last resort. We don't want to be out here. A strike is a big risk, especially with how expensive it is to live out here. So I feel for all our members who are having to come up with other ways to, you know, feed their own families, pay their own bills, and, you know, nothing's going to change unless we really hold Kaiser's feet to the fire. So I'm really proud of my colleagues for taking this step, because we don't do it lightly.
All right. Well, Alana Martucci, Morris, good luck out there. If folks are driving by, honk your horns, get on the picket line, maybe bring some pizzas down, and really appreciate it, and good luck.
Thank you.
All right. Bye-bye.
Bye.
There it is, folks. If you have the opportunity to go by any of those places in Northern California, honk, show your support. If you are a patient of Kaiser Permanente and you have not received timely mental health care from them, go. We have the links that will be on majority.fm and as well in the podcast and YouTube descriptions. We will also post those links where you can contribute to the strike fund if you want. Any amount, I am sure, will be appreciated, and will also give them a sense that there is wide support for what they're doing. You know, it's good. I mean, the fact is that any action where you have workers withholding their labor inspires other workers to take similar actions. You know, we heard about it, whether it's Starbucks and Amazon sort of cross-pollinating themselves and different Amazon places pollinating themselves. Yesterday we had a story about the San Bernardino, I think it was, hub for Amazon, and about 160 workers walked off of about, you know, 1,500 workers, but it was enough to slow things down dramatically. They were inspired by what took place in Staten Island. The folks in Staten Island inspired what they, you know, was going on in Bessemer. That has also inspired folks in Starbucks And the teacher strikes that we saw 4 or 5 years ago, also inspiring people.
And Chicago folks, Intelligentsia Coffee, just elected to unionize there. So that's, you know, show your support to those guys in Chicago as well.
Yeah, very important. I mean, as, you know, we constantly hear from just about anybody who comes on. Fume Taiwo, who was on Monday, I guess.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know what day today is. You know, making the point that really, you know, fundamentally, we're going to need labor. We're going to need unions if there is going to be any real fundamental or even on some level marginal changes in the way that our society is structured. And, you know, at the end of the day, withholding labor continues to be and will always be, I think, in the context, particularly in the context of a capitalist society, but really, I mean, in any society, withholding of labor is certainly workers, but really anybody's greatest weapon.
Yeah, and it's nice to see the culture sort of react or be sort of hospitable to it. The Starbucks Workers United TikTok, they have 3 pinned tweets, and the most recent one has 25 million views.
Wow.
Which is when your entire store walks out after management unjustly fires your coworker for being a union leader.
And we played that on the show, that one. But yeah, apparently that has, like, you know, a mass
25 million views. It's going viral among people who aren't, like, you know, plugged into left politics, for instance.
Yep. Joe Manchin's own Kohl's writes 15,000 nurses of the Minnesota Nurse Association voted Monday overwhelmingly to authorize a strike. I think we mentioned that on Monday, and it remains to be seen if they're going to, but that's the first step, obviously, in basically putting management on notice. Better get back to that bargaining table. All right, we're going to take a quick break and head into the fun half of the program. If you want to be a part of that, 646-257-3920 is the way that we can hear your voice on this show. The other way that we can hear your voice is through your written words, which you can IM. And to IM the program, I think I got an email about this. You need our app. But the app is completely free. And it does not track you. I think we could be one of the only apps that are out there that exist.
We should submit it to some sort of, like, hacker conference and get some award for how not surveillance-y the app is.
I imagine there are other apps out there that don't have, I think it's called, like, the SDK package. And that basically just tracks you wherever you go. And then they take all that data. They don't say, like, you know, Matt Leck is going to, but, you know, guy number 457321, this is what he does. He goes to the head shop, then he goes to the GameStop, and then he goes to GameStop.
Go to the head shop that much.
And they track that and they sell that information to hedge funders who go, like, we should be setting up a GameStop head shop or... We should build a new head shop next to that game shop.
You know what Google started doing is emailing you, like, this is every place you went the last month. You're just kind of
what?
Like, it's very strange. Like, I looked at it and the map is extremely accurate to the point of, like, streets I walked up in Red Lodge, Montana. It's like, oh yeah, I remember walking up to the candy store, and it's like, oh, we tracked all this information here. You have it. And it's like, I don't want you to be tracking my every single step.
That was
I know that they do, but.
That was Google for you, Matt?
Yeah, Google.
Yeah,
that's
like a scary. I've looked at that, and it's just literally like hundreds of dots all over New York. Where you're like, you've been here.
Where do I get that?
It might be an Android phone thing.
I have to. I'll see if I can find that way I did it. But it's just like the data, and it's like, oh my god, it literally is shown every place I've been to. Yeah. Like 8 years.
What were you doing on the Upper East Side? What were you doing in Midtown? Yeah.
Wait, what is this? The military. I got worried when I saw this Militant Apathy just IM'd and said the Majority Report app has the BDE package. And I'm like, oh, Jesus, do we? I thought we didn't have that. And then I realized what BDE meant. Did you guys hear that?
about BDE?
Yeah, we got the BDE package
In our software.
Not the SDK the package, the BDE package.
That's right. Just a reminder. Oh shoot, I missed Al Franken on Jimmy Kimmel last night.
Somebody's got another day. So he'll be doing it tonight, too.
Just a reminder, it is your support that makes the show possible. You can become a member by going to jointhemajorityreport.com. When you do, you not only get the free show free of commercials, but you also help the show survive and thrive going forward. So if you enjoy the show, support it. Jointhemajorityreport.com. Also, don't forget justcoffee.coop, fair trade coffee, tea, or chocolate. Coupon code MAJORITY gets 10% off. It is a co-op. That's why it's justcoffee.coop is the URL. They have a Majority Report blend, great coffee, great employee-owned co-op, and very supportive, all fair trade, of course, very supportive of their suppliers. And don't forget the AM Quickie, folks. I've been remiss. But if you go to amquickie.com, you can sign up for our, as of now, free email newsletter every morning at about 9 a.m. You get some of the top stories from a decidedly lefty perspective. And
biased,
completely biased. And a couple of stories you probably miss. That you will not find in your daily news from some of those other corporate outlets. So check it out, amquickie.com.
Well, Just Coffee in the chat, in the YouTube chat. They said, love you, Sam.
Wait, what's that?
Just Coffee Cooperative is in the YouTube chat.
Sometimes they watch the show. They are? Chat.
Oh, yeah. Okay. Awesome.
Hey, guys.
What's up, guys?
All right. I got distracted. I just saw Freddie from Framingham. Just like you, Sam, I also had my little ballywick as a kid in the 80s. I used to stroke its lustrous mane every day. Jesus, man, dumb it down for us mouth breathers, okay? And by the way, Bob Odenkirk just mentioned you on the Better Call Saul Insider podcast that you wrote the law professor sketch on Mr. Show. Please elaborate. Is that right?
Yeah, another, unless it's the same guy. Someone in chat just said that too, that Bob on the most recent episode mentioned you.
Well, now he has to come on the show.
I don't remember that at all.
You don't remember if you wrote the sketch or?
No, I don't have any recollection of that.
Oh, interesting.
Do you remember the sketch?
No. I mean, I barely remember Bob. I guess it's conceivable there was something maybe that I wrote it.
It sounds like you, lawyer sketch.
I mean, definitely sounds like. It's conceivable it's like based upon something that I wrote in Cross Comedy and maybe that they adapted it.
I said you inspired it. Yeah.
That Dave and Bob wrote it. It could have been something like that, I think. But I was out there when that show was still a stage show.
Was there a Social Security sketch too?
Do you see on the door? You see those magnets? Go grab those magnets. I'll show this, and then we'll go to the fun half. This magnet. Yeah. Yeah, is it stuck? It doesn't come off. It's been on there we've been in this office for 8 years. I think that was the first thing I did. Okay, so this is, this was their logo. And on Mr. Show. And it, this was, I guess they had a convention 96. I don't think they actually had a convention. But this is the logo. And this was drawn by. What's
his name? With Hunter S. Thompson?
Nope.
Oh.
Amy Silver. Amy Silver. She is John Benjamin's partner. I'm not speaking out of turn. They have a child together. And so maybe. People know that. It's been 20-some-odd years. And we were roommates in L.A. for a while, Amy and I, when she drew that. There's a little old Mr. Show trivia for you. For free! We did it on the free half! That should be on the fun half! Matt, what's happening in the Matt Leckie and media universe?
Yeah, we had Brian Muir on last night to talk about Lula versus Bolsonaro, and we're going to have a couple of TMBS regulars on the next couple of Patreon shows. Ben Burgess this weekend to talk about right populism and debunking it, and next week Joshua Kahn Russell to talk about ayahuasca. I'm going to attempt to have a conversation with him that he was planning to have with Michael about it. I'm a little bit less up to date on my psychedelics, it should be a fun conversation anyway. Patreon.com/leftreckoning. Also, leftreckoning.com/store. Stuff is starting to get shipped out, so people should be getting their Left Reckoning merchandise very soon.
All right, folks. See you in the fun half. 3 months from now, 6 months from now, 9 months from now, and I don't think it's going to be the same as it looks like in 6 months from now, and I don't know if it's necessarily going to be better 6 months from now than it is 3 months from now. But I think around 18 months out, we're going to look back and go like, wow.
What? What is that going on?
It's nuts.
Wait a second. Hold on for a second. The Majority
Report. Emma, welcome to the program.
Hey.
Unpacked. Matt.
Who? Unpacked. What is up, everyone?
Unpacked. Nomi Key.
You did it. Unpacked. Let's go, Brandon.
Bradley, you want to say hello?
Sorry to disappoint everyone. I'm just a random guy.
It's all the boys today.
Fundamentally false.
No, I'm sorry. Women's...
Stop talking for a second. Now let me finish.
Where is this coming from, dude?
But, dude, you want to smoke this 7A?
Yes.
Hi, me?
Yes.
Is it me?
It is you.
Is it me? Hello, is this me?
I think it is you. Who is you? No sound. Every single freaking day. What's on your mind?
Sports. We can discuss free markets and we can discuss capitalism.
I'm going to go start
off. Libertarians.
They're so stupid though.
Common sense says of course.
Gobbledygook.
We fucking nailed him.
So what's 79 plus 21?
Challenge met.
I'm positively quivering.
I believe 96, I want to say. 857-210-35-501. One half. 3/8.
9/11, for instance.
$3,400. $1,900.
$6,543 trillion. Sold. It's a zero-sum game.
Actually, you're making me think less.
But let me say this. Poop.
You can call it satire. Sam goes with satire.
On top of it all,
yeah.
My favorite part about you is just like every day, all day, like everything you do.
Without a doubt. Hey, buddy, we see you. All right, folks.
It's just the week being weeded out, obviously.
Yeah, sun's out, guns out. I don't know.
But you should know.
People just don't like to entertain ideas anymore.
I have a question. Who cares?
Our chat is enabled, folks.
I love it.
I do love that.
Gotta jump. Gotta be quick. I gotta jump.
I'm losing it, bro.
2 o'clock, we're already late, and the guy's being a dick, so screw him. Sent to a gulag?
Outrageous.
Like, what is wrong with you?
Love you, bye.
Love you. Bye-bye.